ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, Aussie football champion Sam Kerr faces court for alleged racial harassment more than a year ago. How and why was this kept secret for so long? Also, nuclear power dismissed by the government as too expensive and unnecessary. So why is Canada forging ahead with its first small modular reactor due online in 4 years? And a major shortage of electric vehicle mechanics threatens to send Australia's EV strategy off the road.
Today, I'm no grease monkey, but we're full electronic software diagnostic troubleshooters, you know. So the car has become virtually a computer on wheels.
Thanks for your company. If you were shocked by the news Matilda's Captain Sam Kerr faced a London court charged with the racial harassment of a police officer, you're not alone. Football Australia says they only found out about it, like the rest of us, this morning. It's not known what Kerr is alleged to have said to the officer, but it's claimed the incident happened when police were responding to a complaint about a taxi fare in January last year. Sam Kerr has pleaded not guilty to the charge. Samantha Donovan has more.
Australians were stunned by this morning's news that Matilda's captain, Sam Kerr, has faced a London court charged with the racial harassment of a police officer. But we weren't alone. It was a surprise for the Matilda's coach, Tony Gustafsson, too.
First time I ever heard about it was this morning. I was informed this morning and obviously was surprised and had some time to talk to the Federation about it.
He hasn't spoken to Kerr as yet and says he knows nothing about the nature of the allegation.
The only thing I can comment is my experience and interaction with Sam as a person, as a footballer, and I have only positive experiences from that.
Even Football Australia CEO James Johnson had been unaware of the criminal charge.
I woke up this morning, like everyone else did, to the news, and that's when Football Australia found out about this unsettling event. But look, we're trying to get to the bottom of it at the moment. We've got our own questions that we'd like to know. We've got to find out what actually happened. But we also want to say that there is a process that is underway in the United Kingdom, and you know that process needs to run its course.
Sam Kerr appeared in the London court by video link, charged with using insulting, threatening or abusive words that caused alarm to a police officer. The alleged incident is said to have occurred in Twickenham in the city's southwest last year. The UK law calls the offence racially aggravated harassment. Kerr pleaded not guilty to the charge and was told she must attend a 4-day trial next year. The judge said she understood Kerr's defence was that she didn't intend to distress the officer and the alleged incident wasn't, quote, racially aggravated. Football Australia CEO James Johnson.
Of course, it's very serious allegations. It regards racism and there's no place for racism in our sport. At the same time, Sam has rights, natural justice rights, procedural rights that she's got to work her way through, and we're respectful of that. I haven't spoken to Sam other than a text message just to check in on her well-being, because she is an employee of ours and is also a player.
Dr. Catherine Ordway is the lead researcher in sport integrity at the University of Canberra. She believes a sportsperson would usually be expected to tell their employer they'd been charged with a criminal offence.
It's normally a requirement that players keep their federation and matter of respect to keep their national coaches advised of any kind of matters that could implicate the sport or bring the sport into disrepute is kind of the language used in most of the national sports in Australia. And certainly the Australian Olympic Committee has had a team agreement in place for many, many years that has a positive duty on athletes to advise them once they've been selected in the shadow squad, it's called, to keep them advised if there have been any police matters or any other matters that might have reputational risk for the Olympic Committee or for the sport. So the fact that Football Australia is saying that they weren't aware seems quite surprising.
Canadian Mariam Kurabi is a women's soccer writer and podcaster. She stresses Sam Kerr is innocent until proven guilty, but she feels this controversy could damage the Australian's reputation.
Sam Kerr and her huge impact, both women's football and in Australia and England and really just the sport in general, she is an idol and a role model for many youth and current up-and-coming players. And shall she be found guilty of this? I think it will have a moment for folks to reconsider the role models that they want to follow and really idolize in the game. And I think it would really put a stain on her legacy, because she has done remarkable things on and off the pitch for the sport.
Sam Kerr's four-day trial on this charge is set down for February next year.
Samantha Donovan there. The Prime Minister today unveiled a $2 billion fund to boost trade and investment in Southeast Asia as leaders from the region continue talks at the ASEAN Summit in Melbourne. The strategy is two-pronged: bolster prosperity by building closer ties with the booming region, and also reinforce Australia's strategic position in major emerging economies like Indonesia and Vietnam. And it'll all have a particular focus on clean energy and infrastructure development. Our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts is covering the summit. Stephen, this is no small change. How will this $2 billion investment facility actually work?
Well, essentially, David, what you're going to see with this is that it's a line of credit. So either that's done through loans or just through equity off the government balance sheet, which can be poured into projects in Southeast Asia. Now, there's no guarantee, of course, that a full $2 billion will actually be extended, but that's the amount that the government is at least theoretically putting out there for access. And it's essentially a way to incentivize businesses in Australia to invest into the things that Southeast Asia wants and needs, including infrastructure projects. In particular, there's a focus on clean energy. ASEAN nations are going to have an inexhaustible almost demand for energy as they grow more prosperous over the coming years. But clean energy development has lagged when you compare it to other parts of the world. So the hope here from the government is that Australia and Australian businesses will be more willing to invest into infrastructure like this, which Southeast Asia is going to need. And let's take a listen to the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, explaining what the government's rationale was for making this decision.
What this new investment facility is all about is making sure that we can turbocharge that two-way investment, which is so important to the region, but also to our country, its employers and its workers as well. We recognise that when the region is more secure and more prosperous, our people here in Australia are more secure and more prosperous as well.
That's Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer. Stephen, the Prime Minister has also met with his Singaporean counterpart. What came out of that meeting?
Look, David, there were a lot of fairly minor but worthwhile announcements out of that. There were, however, quite a few questions which were levelled towards both Prime Minister Albanese and also Lee Hsien Loong, his Singaporean counterpart, who's a bit of an elder statesman in the region, about the biggest flashpoint in Southeast Asia, which is the South China Sea. We saw just today a Chinese and a Philippine Coast Guard ships essentially colliding in those contested waters, another sign of just how tense the situation's become. Now, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, he's in a difficult position here. He would love to build the consensus in ASEAN that everyone should agree that China's behaviour is unacceptable, to try and ramp up pressure on Beijing to stop its behaviour or curb its aggression. But there are a large number of states, or rather there are some states in ASEAN which are far too close to Beijing to agree to any sort of attempt like that. And that might explain why Anthony Albanese was so keen to keep it pretty vague when talking about the broad aspirations of what ASEAN hoped to achieve in this space. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
We are holding this summit in the context of the fact that we live in close proximity to the fastest growing region of the world in human history. That presents an enormous opportunity, but it's an opportunity that relies upon international laws being respected, relies upon trade being encouraged in a fair and transparent way.
That's the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese there. Stephen, just briefly, with all this talk about China coming out of ASEAN, the former Prime Minister Paul Keating has had another spray at the Albanese government over its approach to the rising superpower.
Yeah, that's right. You might recall that it was only a few days ago that Mike Burgess, the head of ASIO, dropped a bombshell when he said that a politician had agreed to sell out their country to work essentially for a foreign intelligence service. Now, he did not name the politician nor the country responsible, but Mr. Keating took umbrage at the fact there was an article in the Fairfax Nine papers saying that China was the country he was referring to. Now, The former Prime Minister says that that's a deliberate drop from the spy agencies to the media in an attempt to embarrass China and to interfere with the government's project of stabilisation. Anthony Albanese, though, when asked if the government was sending mixed messages, gave a very brief response, simply saying no. You do get the sense that the government's patience with Mr. Keating's interventions are wearing thin, but I don't think there's anything they can do to stop him.
Stephen Jedgett's reporting there. Well, with ASEAN delegates forming stronger bonds and regional ties in Melbourne, China was spruiking its own economic agenda today. At the opening of the National People's Congress, a rubber stamp parliament, Premier Li Qiang announced China has set an ambitious economic growth target of around 5% for this year. We will get a picture of how the Australian economy is performing tomorrow. But there's no doubt enormous demand from China continues, and that could see us avoid recession and maybe even grow more strongly later this year. For borrowers, there is, though, a nasty catch, as David Taylor explains.
China is among the fastest growing economies in the world, and it's keen to hold on to that growth. Speaking in front of 3,000 delegates from all over the country in the Great Hall of the People, Premier Li Qiang revealed the economy had been growing at 5% per annum. Australia, for context, is growing at roughly 2%. But crucially, the Premier insists China can pull off that kind of growth again this year. ANZ senior economist Catherine Birch reckons it's ambitious.
5% is still pretty strong, particularly for such a big economy, particularly when we know that there's probably going to need to be a bit more stimulus coming through as well to actually reach that target.
After well over a decade of super strong economic growth, China is facing some rather large economic challenges, including deflation or falling prices and a troubled property market. So far, though, those hurdles have not translated into slower Australian economic growth. And actually, given China is Australia's largest trading partner, its economic success to date remains a key support for the Australian economy. Catherine Birch says that will become clear in the release of official economic growth or GDP figures out tomorrow.
One of the things that we will see contributing to growth is net exports, so exports minus imports. And we think that'll add 0.6 percentage points to GDP growth in the quarter. And demand from China is certainly one driver of that.
Yeah, and China's insatiable demand, it seems, for Australian iron ore, gas and coal.
We know that there are some issues in the property sector in China, so that does raise some question marks over, you know, the outlook for demand for things like iron ore that then goes into the steel required for the property market over there. But overall, we are continuing to see the value of exports going to China rise quite sharply, and China's exports grow as a share of Australia's overall exports.
Former Treasury economist Warren Hogan agrees. China's demand for Australia's exports is making up for a lot of economic weakness elsewhere in the economy, especially as households tighten their belts.
This, I think, is what's driving the economy. There is obviously strength coming through from our trade and particularly resource exports, and that came through very clearly in today's data, where we had a near record current account surplus. I think this paints a picture of an economy that is slowed, is in a soft landing. A per capita recession, I think, is the common terminology people are using. But absolutely no signs of it taking the next step down into recession.
But there appears to be a bit of an onion in the economic ointment. Warren Hogan says, if anything, China's economic strength, among other drivers, looks set to propel Australia's economy forward at a pace that may actually spark more inflation. That, economists warn, would force the Reserve Bank to step back in to further slow the economy with higher interest rates.
We all hope they don't have to raise rates any further, but that cannot be ruled out. And I think everyone out there actively in the housing market who have floating rate mortgages should not rule out the fact that interest rates might go up another 50 to 75 basis points later in this year.
The ANZ's Catherine Birch, though, believes the Reserve Bank instead is likely to hold off on cutting interest rates until much later in the year.
While we think that the next move from the RBA will be a cut, we don't think they'll need to cut much. It will be more about reducing the restrictiveness of policy, moving back to neutral rather than actually having to stimulate economic growth.
That's ANZ senior economist Catherine Birch, David Taylor reporting. You're listening to PM. I'm David Lipson. Don't forget all our programs are available live or later on the ABC Listen app. The Coalition's nuclear power policy is starting to take shape, with opposition leader Peter Dutton confirming he wants to replace retiring coal plants with reactors. The government and many local energy experts have dismissed nuclear power as unaffordable, unpopular, and unnecessary for Australia. And Energy Minister Chris Bowen has repeatedly mocked the prospect of small modular nuclear reactors as a mirage. But in Canada, small modular reactors are already taking shape, with the first of many SMRs expected to be switched on in 2028. Now, like Australia, Canada has a net zero by 2050 target. It's also a major exporter of fossil fuels and has vast open spaces ripe for renewables. So why has Canada put so much faith in SMRs? Martin Boucher is a faculty lecturer at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. Martin Boucher, thanks for being with us. Just first of all, tell us, what is Canada doing in terms of small modular reactors?
Yeah, there's a lot of action right now in Canada with small modular reactors, or SMRs as we like to call them. There's, we'll say, a lot of alignment and agreement between a handful of our provinces and the federal government. And we don't have an SMR yet, but it looks like it's very likely that we'll have our first SMR in Ontario at our Darlington nuclear plant by 2028. That's in Ontario. We have other provinces, Alberta, Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, that have also made agreements to deploy or in the process of putting plans together to deploy SMRs. So I'd say there's a lot of momentum and excitement around SMRs in Canada right now.
Why is there so much momentum? Because Australia and Canada are quite similar when it comes to, well, many aspects of energy policy. We've both got a lot of fossil fuels. We've got a lot of open space ripe for renewables. We've both got pretty strong net zero targets, and both have, well, small L Liberal governments at the moment too. What is Canada seeing that Australia isn't?
We also have, similar to Australia, we also have a uranium industry in Canada, so there'd be some sort of alignment there from an industry perspective. I think Canada has a bit more of a history than Australia with nuclear, particularly in Ontario and Canada. We have a strong nuclear legacy and a history of nuclear innovation and, frankly, leadership as well. So that might speak to some of the industry and the competence and these kinds of things, the comfort perhaps with nuclear energy.
What we hear so often from opponents of SMRs here in Australia is that, well, firstly, they're largely unproven, they're very expensive, and, you know, their future is somewhat uncertain. How is Canada overcoming those questions?
I would say I have similar concerns. Although I'm optimistic for SMRs, you know, the history with nuclear energy is that nuclear energy has gone over time, over budget, all of the time. The reason why I'm optimistic for SMRs is because the promise could be really great in terms of reducing emissions at a very significant scale.
Mm. Because we also hear in this country that we don't need nuclear. We can do it easily and more cheaply with renewables and storage, batteries and pumped hydro, and there's no need for any nuclear. Has Canada come to a different view?
There are folks that have that view in Canada as well, that we should have a renewables-only future. But I would say it's also the view that nuclear energy and SMRs in particular can play a significant role, that we have very ambitious goals for net metering. Like, the way that I like to think about it in Canada, our net zero goals, particularly for electricity grid, this is one of the biggest infrastructure projects in Canada's history. This is a very big undertaking, and we need sort of technologies, we need options that really produce significant wins, and nuclear energy could be one of those options.
What about Canada's pathway for EVs, electric vehicles? How's that playing into your and others' calculation on small modular nuclear reactors?
Well, yeah, that strengthened the case for SMRs, because then, so what we're trying to do is reduce emissions to net zero, so not close to zero, net zero, at the same time as significantly increasing the demand on our grid through electric vehicles, which is exciting, but it's also a challenge. And what we've seen so far with our energy transition and our electricity transition, it's gone much slower than we would have hoped for. So I think we need these kinds of technologies that can produce sort of really big wins.
You mentioned this timeline, 2028, that's 4 years away. Are you going to get there? Are you going to be able to achieve this in just 4 years?
I hope so. I'm a bit skeptical, but we'll see. So 2028, just to be clear, is one SMR. Mm. So it's like the first SMR on a nuclear power site in Ontario. Like, so that's a bit of the context. It's not all of the SMRs, it's just one. So, and it's not one of the advanced ones. So it's a simpler technology than other SMR technology. So it's not unreasonable, I would say, but also optimistic.
All right, Martin Boucher, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And Martin Boucher is an expert in energy and public sector entrepreneurship at the University of Saskatchewan. Well, Tasmanians will head to the polls in just a few weeks, and no surprise, it's the cost of living that's at the front of voters' minds. Many families feel worse off than they were the last time a state election was held 3 years ago. Reporter Alexandra Humphreys hit the streets with a community support program in the northern electorate of Bass to see how people are coping.
So I'm just coming to the refrigerated vehicle, and in the back here we've got a food package.
Kirsten Ritchie is the public officer for Strike It Out, a privately funded organisation working across Tasmania's north. She helps people who are homeless access food and other essentials, and makes deliveries to others who do have housing but are struggling to make ends meet.
We're triple demand from probably a year ago. You know, we're struggling to keep up.
So that's your frozen stuff.
Oh, awesome.
Today, Kirsten is making a delivery to a woman in the Launceston suburb of Ravenswood. The woman doesn't want to be named, but she tells me she had a baby a week ago and is facing eviction from the social housing property she's lived in for 4 years because she's behind on her rent.
I ended up in rental arrears because, like, due to Centrelink cutting me off my payments, my rent was being paid. Obviously not being paid a payment from Centrelink. So, yeah, I ended up in rental arrears and now housing want to kick me out due to it. It's actually quite stressful.
The next delivery is across the Tamar River in Trevallon. Single mother Sonia is in a private rental property. It costs her $500 a week.
So by the time I've paid all that, I'm left with like 100 and something bucks to do everything else. I buy Afterpay vouchers to buy groceries, so therefore you're really behind in the long run anyway.
Neither woman has given much thought to the Tasmanian state election, but Sonia is hoping for relief from the cost of living.
I just know there needs to be something, either rent needs to go down or they need to think of the cost of living, food.
Kirsten Ritchie also takes me to a homeless community set up in the shadow of the Launceston Stadium. It's undercover, there's power, and the council has supplied a portaloo. About 14 people are living there. Aged pensioner Greg is one of them.
I've just sort of get my act together now and I'll get into housing again before winter, probably.
In Tasmania, state electorates are represented by multiple MPs. Until now, it's been 5 MPs per electorate, but at the election later this month, it'll increase to 7 per electorate. In 2021, the Liberal Party secured nearly 60% of the primary vote in the Bass electorate, thanks in large part to the popularity of then-Premier Peter Gutwin. Greg thinks Mr. Gutwin did a good job, but he's not been impressed by his successor, Jeremy Rockliffe.
Well, I'll be going for Labor. Liberals, they've just got no idea. They're spending money. They reckon they're going to build a big stadium. They don't need one. If they put that money into the hospitals and the infrastructure, it would make more sense to me.
Nearby, Nicola has travelled for an hour for an appointment at Centrelink, only to discover its doors are locked because it's a local public holiday. She says food prices are making it difficult to feed her family and she wants to see a change.
Probably Labor or the Greens, you know. I think they're looking after us better than and giving us what we need.
Kirsten Ritchie is worried politicians aren't in touch with people struggling the most.
We need a government that's going to do their job. And if they can't do it, come out with us. Come and see the people. Because you're door knocking at the moment. Are you knocking on the right doors? Because I bloody well hope so.
Both major parties have made some cost of living promises so far, including help with power bills and making public transport cheaper.
Then all of a sudden there's all these election promises if they get in. Well, come on. Like, they've had plenty of opportunity to pulled their finger out.
And regardless of the politics, after visiting clients all morning, Kirsten Ritchie will be doing the same again tomorrow.
Alexandra Humphreys there. Australia's transition to electric vehicles is now well underway, with almost 200,000 EVs on the road and many, many more expected in the coming years. One significant obstacle appearing on the road ahead, though, is a serious shortage of electric vehicle mechanics. Motoring experts say there are ways to boost the number of EV mechanics in Australia, but we'd better get started straight away. Here's John Daly.
Sydney-based mechanic Jerry Marson has spent 40 years under bonnets, though these days he spends most of his time looking at a screen, solving software and electrical issues in electric vehicles.
Today, I'm certainly not a grease monkey, but we're full electronic software diagnostic troubleshooters, you know. So the car has become virtually, especially a Tesla, it's virtually a computer on wheels. And when it fails, it'll fail probably 80% of the time due to a software or electronic problem.
The Electric Vehicle Council estimates there are now 180,000 electric vehicles on Australian roads, quite a jump from 83,000 just a few years ago. Jerry Marson says the motor trades have struggled to keep up with the big shift to electric.
Even though I talk to hundreds of different workshop owners, they're all our age, 50 to 60-year-old senior techs or senior owners. All of them had, 99% of them had the same response. They said, oh, stuff it. I'm not going to worry about electric cars. I'll be well and truly gone and retired before they become a reality. Fast forward now in the last couple of years, well, I don't know what the percentages are, but the percentages have skyrocketed, especially in Teslas.
Right now, there's a major shortage of mechanics able to do these repairs. A Deloitte and Motor Trades Association of Australia report has found just 41% of advertised roles for EV technicians were filled last year. And that fill rate drops to 33% in regional areas. Sean Meyer runs EV North in northern Queensland. And he says it's hard to compete with other industries like mining and attract young people into the trade.
Yeah, well, the base wage is only like $26 an hour. A tradesman, you know, you can get other jobs out there that are, you know, pay more and a lot easier. You don't have to do a trade. You don't have to do 4 years. You don't have to be skilled.
That shortage could get a lot worse when the government introduces the new vehicle efficiency standard, requiring car makers to sell more efficient cars, including EVs. Motor Trades Association of Australia Chief Executive Matt Hobbs.
We're going to need more people because the electric cars are coming. We're forecasting at least 2 million on the roads by 2030. That's a lot of cars to fix, and we need the right people in the pipeline ready to fix them when that comes.
Matt Hobbs says there are solutions, and he's in Canberra today making his pitch to the government.
Recognise that the fuel efficiency standard is a huge structural adjustment, and you just can't do that policy. You've got to look at skills. You've got to look at franchising laws. You've got to look at the whole industry to work out how to help the industry transition to this future state of a lot of EVs. And there is a real need to ensure that they have a coordinated policy that's not just fuel efficiency standards.
Matt Hobbs says there are three ways to fix the shortage. Firstly, somehow get more young people into motor trade apprenticeships and give more support for programs to upskill existing motor mechanics. Finally, streamline visas to bring in overseas EV mechanics. At the moment, about a quarter of advertised EV mechanic jobs are filled by overseas workers. The Motor Trades Association wants the emerging occupation added to the skills list to help make visa sponsorship less expensive for the motor industry.
Yeah, we want to make sure that we use all the levers we've got because the need is great. Our preference is to train people and bring people into the workforce That's always the best solution. But we also have to know that this has been a problem for a long time, and we have to look at if there are skilled people that we can bring to Australia, that we should have that conversation.
That's Matt Hobbs from the Motor Trades Association of Australia, who was speaking to our reporter, John Daly. That's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. The PM team will be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. For more than 20 years, Australians have turned to Botox when unwanted wrinkles begin to emerge. So why have regulators decided to crack down on it now? Today we speak to a long-time Botox user and a health law expert about why we need to rethink what we're injecting. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.